Thank you, Gerald, for that helpful review of Dr. Kirk's contributions and for the generous introduction to my remarks. It was with some wistfulness that I left behind the last fragment of that wicked good apple pie, but it'll be better for me, no doubt, in the long run to move on to other things. I want to thank the Philadelphia Society and its officers for the opportunity to consider with you here the importance of permanent things. As many of you have already gathered, if you didn't know, I am certainly no Kirk expert, but I could not endorse more warmly his praise of permanent things. And I'm grateful for this opportunity in your company to ponder the status of the permanent things in America then and now. It's good, let me say, to see many old friends, some after years or even decades, and to make new friends in this distinguished group. I was prompted by the mention of Scott Fitzgerald's passage here at the Georgian Terrace that mentioned last night to reread an excellent review of the most recent film version of The Great Gatsby. What makes Gatsby great? Why the title, The Great Gatsby? This, according to critic Martha Bayless, from whom I will borrow much now in this introduction, this question, what makes Gatsby great, is the question a filmmaker would have to answer, or at least to ponder, in order to make a movie in any way worthy of Fitzgerald's 1925 classic. Baz Luhrmann's recent effort, according to Bayless, doesn't come close. Louder, crasser, and more frantic even than his earlier films, as Bayless writes, this summer's Great Gatsby leaves her asking, why would anyone want to inflict such damage on a novel that never did anything to him? Of course, as Bayless notes, there is no little irony in the title, since Jay Gatsby is at best an ambivalent character, having built a fortune on corruption in order to get close socially to the girl of his dreams, Daisy, a married girl. But the longing evoked by Gatsby's gazing across the bay at the green light at the end of Daisy's dock cannot be reduced to a desire for the girl, no matter what Jay Gatsby himself might think. It cannot be Gatsby's love for Daisy that makes him great because, as Bayless writes, she's so clearly not worth it. So there must be some other reason, excuse me, not represented in any of the films, why the narrator, Nick Carraway, affirms to Jay, you're worth the whole damn bunch of them put together. You're worth the whole damn bunch put together. What then makes Gatsby great? Bayless suggests two distinct ways in which he is worth the whole damn bunch put together. First, he retains at least a residual moral decency, which he demonstrates by taking the blame for the hit-and-run death that Daisy has caused. Second, there is Gatsby's longing itself, directed towards the implausibly green-tinted light at the end of the distant dock, which to Bayless recalls Beatrice's cloak of green, the color of hope, which she is wearing when Dante finally meets her in the earthly paradise at the end of the Purgatorio. Jay Gatsby is morally capable of a great sacrifice for another human being, and Jay Gatsby longs for a god he cannot name. There is a greatness in Gatsby that is both moral and spiritual intellectual. I will resist the temptation to speculate on how the one kind of greatness is related to the other, moral on the one hand, spiritual, intellectual on the other. Suffice it to say that this question has been the axis of Western political philosophy from Plato through Leo Strauss. Alexis de Tocqueville's first impressions of America were not very promising concerning any place for permanent things. Here is one of Tocqueville's first impressions of America, recorded in a letter he wrote to a friend in France early in his visit to the New World in 1831. The American's instability of character breaks through in 1,000 places. Change seems to him the natural state of man, and how could it be otherwise? Everything is ceaselessly astir around him. Laws, opinions, public officials, fortunes, the earth itself here changes its face every day. But Tocqueville would soon come to understand the roots of an order that contained and supported the restless motion of the Americans. Democracy in America, as many of you know, is rich with accounts of such roots. For example, Tocqueville argues that it was the long development of freedom within an English tradition, along with the exceptional circumstances of freedom in a new world, that had saved America from the kind of radical social revolution that had convulsed his native France and was still convulsing it. And Tocqueville gave credit, great credit, to the wisdom and virtue of the United States' founding statesmen, who had framed a new constitution and taught a restless people to accept it. But the two deepest and strongest roots of American order for Tocqueville, I would argue, are these. On the one hand, the township or the self-governing small local community, the primeval source, I would say, of the American genius for free association, and the Christian religion, especially in the form of the austere activism of the Puritans. The township and Christianity, nature and grace, the natural root of self-government that precedes the division between aristocracy and democracy, a basic form of community that facilitates a kind of synthesis of quality and equality, and the divine revelation of a transcendent human destiny that places strict and sacred limits on natural passions and appetites. Virtuous liberty prospers in the self-governing township. Communal responsibilities call forth the best efforts of the most able citizens. The best effectively rule and set the tone for the community without becoming an artificial aristocracy. At the same time, Christian dogma and Christian morality set an absolute limit on the restless spirit of innovation and provide a stable framework, both cosmic and domestic, for the perpetuation of institutions favorable to the virtues of self-government. Revealed religion grounds and shelters the natural growth of responsible freedom in local communities. Religion in America, Tocqueville writes, must be regarded as the foremost of the political institutions of that country. For if it does not impart a taste for freedom, it facilitates the use of free institutions. Note that it does not impart the taste, but it facilitates the use, the Christian religion. The taste for virtuous freedom or for the free exercise of the natural virtues, for the flourishing of man's higher natural faculties, may not have been well articulated in the austere Calvinism of America's first founders, but the moral strictness of the Puritan religion provided a stable framework for the development of such a virtuous freedom. Russell Kirk wrote in Roots of the American Order that what America's founding generation learned from Plato, however indirectly, was to understand justice or political order as grounded in the order of the soul. He agreed with Tocqueville that America's practical experience with communal self-government, together with its unquestioned Christian dogma and morality, provided fertile ground for the growth of orderly souls in the midst of ceaseless motion that roiled American society. The root of American order was an order of the soul that arose from the coexistence of local self-government with an austere and moralistic Christianity. But this order cannot be identified simply with either the one or the other of these sources. Americans are heirs of a classical and Christian tradition of virtue, ordered by an awareness of permanent things, that they honor more in their practice than in any theory or doctrine they possess. Tocqueville and Kirk know that political freedom cannot flourish and stay within safe limits without some account of permanent things, of the divine. And they also know that the austere commands of the Calvinist God need to be informed by some experience of natural and concrete human goods, some experience of a virtue that survived man's fall from grace. Tocqueville's Americans do not possess a theory or theology that adequately mediates between nature and grace. But the experience of local self-government within the moral limits of a commanding God provides such mediation in practice. Americans live in awareness of permanent things, of enduring natural and divine goods, even if they cannot give an account of them. To return to Fitzgerald's image, for the Americans of Tocqueville's day, the green light of spiritual hope, barely visible through the mists that separate fallen man from God, this light is sufficient to support the practice of virtuous freedom. Let us now consider more closely the dependence of ordered liberty on a transcendent hope. The natural goodness of the township, that is, of the exercise of virtuous freedom, cannot stand alone. Natural virtue needs revealed religion, if only because it needs protection against restless religious longings that threaten to invade the political sphere and to produce extreme political ambitions. Quoting Tocqueville again, "The short space of 80 years can never content the imagination of man, nor can the imperfect joys of this world satisfy his heart. Man alone, of all created beings, displays a natural contempt of existence and yet a boundless desire to exist. He scorns life, but he dreads annihilation. These different feelings incessantly urge his soul to the contemplation of a future state, and religion directs his musings thither. Religion, then, is simply another form of hope, and it is no less natural to the human heart than hope itself. Men cannot abandon their religious faith without a kind of aberration of intellect and a sort of violent distortion of their true natures." End of quote. Virtuous freedom on a natural human scale will never fully satisfy the human heart. If infinite longings are not directed towards the transcendent, they will inevitably be projected upon the political order. This is the root of all varieties of modern secular ideology, in which, as the order of the soul gives way, the order of the soul gives way to the passion for social justice. Some have known this under the tag of the immanentization of the eschaton. If the green light at the end of the dock is not associated with a transcendent destiny of the soul, then the passion for Daisy will sooner or later take a political form, the form of a secular salvation. And once religious hopes are fixed upon worldly ends, then some Tom Buchanan will always be setting the tone and calling the shots. The most idealistic quest for social justice will find itself defined by the harsh necessities of power politics. In Tocqueville's America, the experience of justice as order in the soul was oriented by religious hope, but it was also already in Tocqueville's time somewhat intermingled with an ideological passion for what we now call social justice, that is, with dreams of limitless progress and an insatiable passion for equality. Social justice denies the primacy of a concrete moral order, of personal virtue and responsibility, in a particular and finite context. Social justice seeks an abstract fairness and equality, and this quest tends perpetually to undermine existing habits and institutions of virtue. Justice as a personal virtue, as order in the soul, always requires the acceptance of limitations and necessities inherent in the human condition, accepting them to rise above them and do one's duty regardless of excuses that one might find in one's material or social circumstances. In this sense, real human freedom is inseparable from acceptance of suffering. To do what is right is always to refuse excuses that one might find in circumstances beyond one's control. The abstract idealism of social justice, on the other hand, proposes to defer the obligation to do what is right until the fairness of the circumstances has been secured, a condition which, of course, can never be met. Human problems are the fault of society. Human failings can be fixed only by fixing society. Human beings have to be fixed from the outside in and not from the response of a moral insight within. There is thus an inherent tension between justice in its two meanings, justice as order in the soul, as a personal virtue, and social justice as an ideological vision and a collective project. This tension between justice as order in the soul under God and the collective or historical project of social justice became the focus of a titanic struggle in the 20th century, which the older among us will still remember quite well, and of which it is good to remind those too young to remember it, because it is not much discussed these days, and we often think that the great battle for freedom, the international battle of the 20th century, is over and irrelevant. Far from it, I would like to suggest. No one lived this titanic struggle in his own mind and soul as intensely or with more lucidity than Whitaker Chambers, the former communist who provided his witness against the purest and most virulent form of the dream of social justice. When Chambers could no longer suppress his awareness of the moral evil of communism, measured by a traditional, a permanent standard of justice as order in the soul, when he could no longer deny communism's evil, its destruction of all permanent things, then Chambers was forced to make the most fundamental of choices, that between God and man as ultimate authorities. By rejecting communist ideology and repenting of his participation in the worldwide communist conspiracy, Chambers knew that he was also forsaking the conspiracy of progressives and intellectuals that derived from the 18th century Enlightenment, the vision of rationalistic liberalism in general. He was abandoning, that is, the quest for a social justice that would transform the human condition, and he was accepting to live within a permanent moral order that required acceptance of the limitations of that human condition. Quoting Chambers, "The idea that man is sinful and needs redemption has been subtly changed into the idea that man is by nature good and hence capable of indefinite perfectibility. This perfectibility is being achieved through technology, science, politics, social reform, education. Man is essentially good, says 20th century liberalism, because he is rational, and his rationality is, if the speaker happens to be a liberal Protestant, divine, or, if he happens to be religiously unattached, at least his rationality is benign. Thus, the reason-defying paradoxes of Christian faith are happily bypassed." Chambers does not pause here to explain what reason-defying paradox lies at the heart of Christian faith, and I will not here attempt any theological exploration of Christian mysteries. But we can already see, I think, the outlines of this paradox in the very opposition between justice as the order of the soul under permanent things and justice as social justice, as the boundless quest for some perfect equality and fairness. The order of the soul requires the acceptance of limitations in the human condition and even of suffering. The green light on the dock of transcendence is a beacon of hope. but also a reminder of our permanent distance as mortals from our spiritual home, and a reminder of the harsh limitations of our mortal condition. To be guided and uplifted by the hope, the transcendent hope, we must also be humbled to accept the limitations of our present condition and of our rational powers. The demand to overcome such limitations excuses immorality in the name of progress and undermines the order of the soul. When social justice replaces justice as a personal virtue, then we attempt to lay our mortal hands on the green light of transcendence, and Daisy's beauty is reduced to Tom Buchanan's libertinism and ruthless corruption. Another mid-20th century American author, the Catholic novelist Flannery O'Connor, saw with bracing clarity what was at stake in the alternative between justice as order in the soul under permanent things and social justice. Quoting Flannery O'Connor, in this popular pity, compassion, maybe even sensitivity and tolerance, as these terms are used today, in this popular pity, we mark our gain in sensibility or sensitivity and our loss in vision. If other ages felt less, they saw more, even though they saw with the blind, prophetical, unsentimental eye of acceptance, which is to say, of faith. In the absence of this faith now, we govern by tenderness, by compassion, by caring. It is a tenderness which, long since cut off from the person of Christ, is wrapped in theory. A very profound insight of O'Connor's, I think. If our tenderness is cut off from any divine source, it can only be wrapped in theory, that is, in an abstract, rational project to master the human condition. When tenderness is detached from the source of tenderness, its logical outcome is terror. It ends in forced labor camps and in the fumes of the gas chamber. Miss O'Connor didn't pull any punches there or elsewhere. We think, left far behind the epic battle between communism and the free world. But if Whitaker Chambers and Flannery O'Connor are right, there will always be a high price to be paid for any attempt to emancipate the ideological quest for social justice from the order of the soul and from the authority of the permanent things that can only uplift us if they humble us. Tocqueville was relieved to find that in America, the awful maxim that nothing is immoral that serves the interests of society, he found that in America, to his relief, this maxim, this utilitarian maxim, found no acceptance. How do we stand with respect to this today? Today, our leading academic, moral, and political theorists, followers, for example, of the late John Rawls, whom I learned last night, Russell Kirk was in his last days preparing to refute. Our leading theorists and moral lights take it for granted from the outset that there is no basis for morality but public reason. That is, whatever society can be persuaded serves its interests. Whatever society can be persuaded by progressive intellectuals serves its interests. No limit on morality beyond that. Society, for many, is the new God. And no revolution was necessary, it appears, or has been necessary so far, to bring about this fundamental reorientation from the permanent things to the assumption of human mastery. Tocqueville's analysis may be once again coming true, but in not so happy a sense. We have moved into a radical secularism without a revolution that called this to our attention. Does the United States of America still live and have its being under the permanent things? Are we still blessed by the green light of hope and sobered by the necessary distance that separates us from it? Tocqueville, 180 years ago, went to America to look for an alternative to the moral and spiritual confusion wrought by those he called the would-be champions of modern civilization. Those proud and ambitious intellectuals who proposed to make men masters of their fate by reducing them to material beings beholden to no higher authority. Appalled by the spiritual disorder of the old world to which these progressive intellectuals had contributed, appalled by this disorder, Tocqueville found hope, despite everything, in the ordered liberty of the Americans. The great Frenchman, in effect, said to America, "You're worth the whole damn bunch put together." Would to God that it may yet be so. Thank you.